We'll delve into the August 20th, 2013 rain report in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the studios of the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, with this rain report. The tendency when looking back at history of ham radio is for we stateside hams to dwell on amateur radio with our own national borders, and very little on the cooperation and amateur radio developments across the pond in the UK, the United Kingdom. At the 2013 Dayton Hamvention, Graham Coomber, G0MBI, president of the RSGB, the Radio Society of Great Britain, presented a paper that took a cursory look at the involvement of both the U.S. and the U.K. in the advancement of amateur radio in the past century. This week, we bring you the second and final excerpt from his presentation.
Amateur radio has always meant international friendship, and never was that more clearly demonstrated than during the Second World War. In February 1941, the managing secretary of the ARRL, Ken Warner, W1EH, wrote to the RSGB, concerned over the difficulties in the food situation, or rationing as we knew it in Britain. ARRL president George Bailey, W1KH, and the ARRL staff decided to do something to help their fellow amateurs, and promptly sent cocoa, marmalade, granulated sugar, and several pounds of tea across the Atlantic. They sent it in two parcels a few days apart, valued at just $5 and $6 each. Warner was most concerned about the chances of the packages arriving safely, and encouraged Claricoat's G6CL to write back and let them know so they could send more parcels. He also reported that it looked like most of September and December QST magazines destined for the UK had been lost at sea. In April, Claricoat's wrote back, saying that both parcels had arrived safely and how much they were appreciated. Warner stated in his May letter that, with that successful experience behind us, we want to try it some more. So the next package was prepared. This contained tinned meat, 3 tins of chicken, 2 tins of ox tongue, 1 of roast beef and 1 of frankfurters, almost $9 worth. The letter also talked about how national defence matters had started appearing in QST, one called In the Services, as nearly 3,000 amateurs were naval reservists, with a similar number in the Army. The other section was called USA Calling, and was a compilation of the calls of the armed forces and civilian agencies that need radio personnel likely to come from amateur ranks. One interesting item was the problems with interference from 2 BBC stations on the 7 MHz band. The stations were putting out Empire News, and the BBC had no plans to stop the transmissions. Warner notes that, if BBC is using directive antennas, it is obvious that something is out of kilter, and they are losing a lot of power behind the antenna that is not doing useful work for them. So I am endeavouring to find out whether it is in order to make a technical report on the matter, which might result in readjustment of the transmitter in such a manner as to cut down the American interference. A couple of months later, Claricoat's wrote back, saying that the parcel of tin meat had arrived safely, and that if the ARRL hadn't sent earlier parcels of tea and marmalade, they would have been well out of stock. He also mentioned that the cocoa had been sent was much appreciated because it was streets ahead of anything we get here. Sadly, not all the parcels got through, and it wasn't because of the U-boats either. Some parcels were seized by HM Customs and Excise because they contained more than 2 pounds of tea, the maximum you allowed. Undeterred, and with typical amateur inspiration, the ARRL promptly sent more parcels, but this time with only 1.5 pounds of tea, plus 6 large chocolate bars and a small bag of candy. Also, Claricoat's was also pleased to discover that the BBC had removed the station broadcasting on 7150 kHz, and so the US stations had much better reception. Apparently, the BBC had been troubled with an echo from the antenna that the ARRL had identified as the culprit. Help in the way of food parcels and food vouchers didn't only come from the USA, of course, and after the war ended, the Wireless Institute of Australia, Queensland Division sent parcels to the UK, and a ballot was held to choose the members that receive these parcels. Many letters of thanks were sent back to Australia with every delivery. The National Society of South Africa also joined the ARRL in sending these very welcome parcels until the 1950s, and another club helping UK amateurs during those difficult days was the Ontario Phone Club. Many members were very thankful for the generosity of other amateurs around the world, and these acts were truly gestures of real amateur friendship. A limited number of 50 to 54 megahertz permits were issued by our post office in November 1947, and the work that these experimenters did really paid off. Following this, a period of crossband contacts between 50 and 28 megs took place across the Atlantic. Dennis Heitman, G6DH, had decided the only way to improve the chance of transatlantic QSOs, when the permission was granted, would be to build a beam antenna. He completed his three-element beam from scratch and mounted it some 38 feet above the ground. On the 5th of November of that year, W1HDQ called on 50 MHz and worked G6LK crossband on 28 megs. Dennis G6DH then gave him a quick call, and as he had one of the new 50 megs permits, asked the American to listen up on 50 MHz right away. At 1301 GMT, Dennis called W1HDQ, and he replied immediately with an S7 report. The first 50 MHz transatlantic contact from England. The contact was very good, but they kept to it about only for 10 minutes, because others were waiting to make the transatlantic contact. Dennis went on to work W2AMJ, W1LLL, W8MVG, W1AF, and W1CLS. Amateur satellites. Was it coincidence or design that led to the satellite carrying amateur radio, which was Project Oscar, orbital satellite carrying amateur radio, going into orbit exactly 60 years to the day after Marconi and his college Kemp at Signal Hill, Newfoundland, heard for the first time a wireless signal that had originated from the other side of the Atlantic? The tiny capsule contained a transmitter operating on a frequency close to 145 MHz and orbited the Earth every 91 minutes. Providing excitement and interest unparalleled in amateur radio circles since those first transatlantic tests nearly 40 years earlier. Reception reports reached the RSG within a few hours of the launch, and by the time the ARRL opened for business on the 13th of December 1961, a telegram of congratulations had reached them from the RSGB, as well as one to the Project Oscar Center in California. Project Oscar was sponsored by the ARRL, and it was thanks to the cooperation of the US government that the transmitter was given space on board a research satellite. The transmitted signal was high in CW. In the UK, the first report of the signals came from G3OSS, who heard them at 0055 GMT on the 13th of December. The Doppler shift of frequency due to the high velocity of the satellite was measured at about 7 kHz. Details of the signals were passed on to W1FRR on 80 meters SSB, who relayed the message to the Project Oscar Association in the US. Sadly, the satellite failed earlier than was expected, but not before there was time to complete most of the main objectives of the investigation. The last proper signal was heard early on the 30th of December. By 11:16 GMT, the keying system had failed, and only II was being transmitted. A number of stations heard a continuous note on 144.96 MHz at 2305 GMT. The strain on the batteries was just too much, and the power had reduced to a small fraction of the original 100 milliwatts. It continued with this warbling note until the 3rd of January, at weaker and weaker levels. At the end of the experiment, more than 2,500 reports had been sent in from around the world, and reception distances of around 1,400 miles were reported.
You're listening to a 2013 Dayton Hamvention presentation about the last 100 years of cooperation and development in ham radio between the U.S. and the United Kingdom by Graham Coomber, G0MBI, president of the RSGB, the Radio Society of Great Britain. We'll conclude our excerpts from Graham's paper in a moment. This is the RAIN Report, Building Bridges Through Amateur Radio.
You're listening to The RAIN Report from www.therainreport.com.
The first transatlantic 70 to 50 MHz QSO took place on the 17th of November 1980 at 1627 UTC between G4BPY and VE1ASJ. The received signal from Canada was 5 and 9, while the CW from the UK was 339 in Canada. It's that power problem and aerials again, isn't it? Paul Turner, G4IGE, made was what was probably the first transatlantic 50 MHz slow scan television contact contact at 1320 UTC on the 22nd of November 1989. He received a picture from Dave Foucher, WA1UQC, on 50.23 MHz. Dave was running 300 watts to a six-element Yagi at 50 feet and a robot 1200C scan converter. Paul used a TS-660 and a homebrew RGB frame store. All the SSTV signal processing was done via a BBC Micro. 2A SSTV also took place over the following 2 days between WA1UQA and G3NOX, G1LXI and G4IJE. Amateur radio in space. In 1983, one of the astronauts on board the STS-9 space shuttle was Dr. Owen Garriott, W5LFL, and he obtained permission to take a 144 MHz handheld on board, running 5 watts into a printed circuit board antenna placed in the upper crew compartment window on the aft flight deck. During his free time, Garriott transmitted on the even minutes and received on the odd minutes. During the receive periods, he logged all the call signs he heard and then acknowledged them in the transmit minute. He recorded about 290 amateurs around the world during the flight, although his transmissions were logged on Earth by many thousands more. Gloria Hills, G4UYL, Jan Niven, G6EGY, Sue Nelson, GM8NXC, and J.W. Hoyland, G6DEF, were among the 5 UK amateurs who were recorded as UK contacts. Of course, probably the highest profile contact was with RSGB member JY1, King Hussein of Jordan. Those who managed a two-way contact received personally signed QSL cards. And Garriott's son, Richard, W5KWQ, flew to the space station in 2008, and he spoke from there to Bud Broke schoolchildren in Warwickshire, England. And in 2009, Richard visited the school, spoke to the children that he'd met that he'd spoken to whilst in space. Our history as regards emergency communications is nothing compared to yours, of course. But in talking about our history, I just must spend just a couple of moments talking about that tragedy called Lockerbie. And RAYNET, which is our emergency communication system. At the very end of 1989, RAYNET personnel in Scotland were called to assist in one of aviation's most tragic events, the Lockerbie disaster. Teams from Dumfries and Galloway and Strathclyde turned out, and operations began at 2200 UTC. One of the controllers recalled his first impressions. There were rows and rows of ambulances, fire hoses were stretched across the road, and groups of people had gathered in the street. The smell of burning hung over the town. RAYNET set up communication links between Lockerbie and Dumfries, something they maintained for 10 days. The teams passed messages to and from the emergency planning officer in Dumfries and handled traffic for the Scottish Ambulance Service. They also set up several bases and provided operators for the search areas. In true amateur spirit, help from other groups in Scotland, England and Wales was immediately offered. At the time, the Scottish RAYNET provided communications for not only the emergency planning folk and police search rescue teams, but also for the air accident investigation, the search and rescue dogs, police dogs, the Salvation Army, underwater search units, the Red Cross and rescue helicopters. The teams even worked two ships on Christmas Day. Altogether, some over 7,000 man-hours were provided by around 80 operators each day. The teams finally stood down at 1720 UTC on the 31st of December 1989, a truly remarkable effort in extremely difficult circumstances. Right up to the present day now, US amateurs have often spoken at our convention, which we hold in October each year. 5 streams of lectures over 2 days attract a large number of amateurs from the UK, Europe, and even further afield. And last year, we were very pleased to have Greg Marco, W6IZT, visit and spoke on the HK0NAD expedition. It was standing room only, as the audience was both amazed and horrified at some of the conditions under which they operated. Many in the room had worked the station on several bands. Seeing the effort it took to get the signals out there made the QSLs that bit more valuable. And just to finish up with an unashamed advert for my National Radio Centre, and work commenced in January 2010 on the RSGB's National Radio Centre based at Bletchley Park. The centre is a world-class showcase for radio communications technology as a force powering the 21st century economy, and to present amateur radio as an exciting, stimulating, educational, multifaceted hobby which provides a sound technical grounding in radio communication for those within its ranks. Whilst the NRC is not a museum, there is a legacy area where outstanding examples of amateur radio equipment through the 20th century and our centenary are exhibited. There's also a library reference area and archive, most of which the history that I've given you today has come from. And access, you're welcome to visit on an appointment basis if you wish to research the extensive archives that the RSGB has built up over the time. On unveiling the plaque at the entrance on the opening last year, Ed Vasey, a Member of Parliament, said, "The National Radio Centre will do an enormous amount to spread the knowledge about the history of radio and its continuing importance in the 21st century. The RSGB is technically populated by amateurs, but it is actually full up to the brim with technical professionals who have done an amazing job here. What really appeals to me about the work that the RSGB does is the importance of introducing young people to technology. It gives them great purpose with the ability to build something and then have the possibility to talk to someone on the other side of the globe, which can fill them with excitement. The NRC is a great reminder of Britain's place in the history of radio and the incredibly important role that Britain has played in developing radio, and we still pioneer, not just in the field of amateur radio, but also in the field of digital radio." So, in conclusion, we've achieved much together during the last 100 years, and it's been a privilege for me to have the opportunity of, if you like, reminiscing with you today. I guess the challenge that we both face is to do it all again in the next 100 years. There will be many obstacles, not least of which is pressure on the spectrum from other users. But together, I'm sure that we will provide the leadership necessary to ensure that amateur radio survives and indeed prospers. And so may I end by sending early centenary greetings to the ARRL for 2014. We are having great fun celebrating ours, and I'm sure, just like your aerials, it will be bigger and even better.
This has been the second excerpt from a paper delivered during the 2013 Dayton Hamvention by RSGB President Graham Coomber, G0MBI, looking back at the cooperation and development of ham radio in the past century between the U.S. and the U.K. Congratulations to the RSGB for their first 100 years of service. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2013 Rain, all rights reserved. Now, for Rain's founder-producer Hap Holly, KC9RP, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, bidding you a very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network, www.therainreport.com.